looking forward to going to Dunloe tomorrow morning. We're broadcasting the show live from Kavanagh Super Value as part of the Mary from Dunloe International Festival. So if you're in and around the area, please feel free to drop in and say hello. We've got lots of great guests, and to sample the atmosphere and see what's going on as well. It's a big day tomorrow, so we're looking forward to being down there. Though David James did everything on Wednesday, so we're going to have to really think out of the box for new content, aren't we? Speaking of content, I've got a jar full of content, blackcurrant and red mix, and it's a gift brought in from Paul McLaughlin from Ballacturg Garden Centre. Is this a family affair? Is this the product you and your daughters work on, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, I know the whole family, even the son was involved this year.
Okay.
To be honest, that's why it's a blackcurrant and redcurrant mix.
Because he says, right, this needs more red currants or what?
No, pretty much they just run out in one bowl. Okay. Everything into it rather than separate them out, if you know what I mean.
All right, so where would you pick the black and red currants for this?
Just from the garden there.
Yeah.
There would be maybe probably 8 or 9 bushes there.
Mm-hmm. If I open that, does it spoil it? I open it and smell it and it doesn't spoil
no,
it?
No, no, no. You'd be around for 6 months or so.
It smells delicious.
That's the traditional way people had of preserving their fruit.
Yeah.
As the high sugar content sort of makes it.
So how do you do that, right? So you go out and get your bowl, bring it into the kitchen.
Yeah.
It goes into a bigger bowl, does it?
Or pretty much into the big saucepan.
Okay.
That I had a borrow from my mother. Mm-hmm. So it did, but she had a big jam making saucepan. But just basically in there, a wee touch of water, boil it up, let it cool again. That's classed as jelly more than jam, in the sense I strained a lot of the kids don't particularly like all the bits.
Okay, so the pips and things.
Exactly, yeah. So you just over the course just sieve the juice.
Yeah.
And basically then you weigh the juice, weigh the sugar, mix it with a wee squish of lemon juice.
Yeah.
And boil up for a while.
And where does it get its volume from? Do you know what I mean? It is like a gelatine almost now.
Yes.
Is that in the boiling process?
Pretty much there's pectin in the fruit.
Okay.
And pectin's what sort of solidifies it a lot. I suppose that combined with the sugar.
Yeah. So what's the difference? What you're saying, that's, what is this? Is it a jam?
Yeah. Well, it's a jelly.
Right. So what's the difference between a jam, a jelly and a preserve? Because if you go into the supermarket, it's a lot of stuff that I think is jam. They call it preserve.
Yes, I think that's just trying to be fancy.
Is it really?
As anything else.
Okay.
Like I say, traditionally that was a way of preserving fruit. People had a bounty at this time of year.
Yeah, of course.
That they wanted for the winter, mm-hmm. but it obviously wouldn't keep the berries because they had no refrigeration or anything or freezing. So they made it into jams or jellies.
Do you think now that it's gone through that process and sugar's entered the equation, that it still retains a nutritional value, or is it just something tasty to carry you through the winter that you preserved from the summer, I wonder?
A certain amount of nutritional value, but I'd say the sugar does sort of...
Yeah. It's not one of your five a day?
No. I would certainly doubt it.
All right, brilliant stuff. But, and what way do you like it? On a scone with a bit of cream, on a bit of toast? What way will it be consumed in the McLaughlin household?
Pretty much most of the time, if you're been fancy the scones maybe, but generally it goes in the toast.
Yeah, that treat is unfortunately few and far between. Right, so the 1st of August is an important day on the calendar, historically anyway, maybe contemporarily. Lunasa. And
yes.
We all know about Lunasa between, you know, it's mm-hmm. been plays from Glenties and all that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
So talk to me about Lunasa.
Funny, Lunasa is one of the four main Celtic festivals. So it'd be sort of celebrating the coming of the harvest as much as anything else. So very important for Donegal in terms of it's named after the god Lu, who actually was born in Tory Island and back in history or whatever.
Wow.
He was a grandson of Bower of the Evil Eye, who famously lived in Tory. So he was. So... Was through the whole Celtic world, like even into France, Lu would have been the god of the sun. And sort of now coming into harvest time, they placated him with gifts and stuff tomorrow, traditionally, with to guarantee a good harvest.
So if it was a good day, August 1st, it would be a good sign of your harvest season.
Exactly, aye. And what I got, a bad day tomorrow is generally a bad sign. It's stormy weather. On Lunasa, generally, would be seen as a bad omen for the harvest to come.
So, obviously, traditional timelines have shifted, I presume. Correct mm-hmm. me if I'm wrong, this sounds like a really silly question, but, you know, with fertilising and all that kind of stuff, has that altered what is harvesting season, or would it actually still be traditionally harvesting season coming up?
Traditionally, around that, you would be chatting sort of further south. They'd be nearly harvesting now, if you know what I mean.
And what kind of stuff?
Sort of barley, oats, stuff. They'd be harvesting now. Whereas up here, we tend to be a wee bit later. You'd be nearly into the first days of September a lot of the time before it's ready.
Yeah.
So it would be.
There's kind of a sense the summer's over when you talk to people. Do you know what I mean? Because mm-hmm. we had this consistent kind of icky weather.
Yes.
And, of course, you know, some unseasonable windy weather being forecast for the start of next week. But we are, where are we in terms of the summer season, yes, the gardening season? Are we smack bang in the middle? Are we in the autumn of it or what?
No, pretty much we should be. Pretty much we're...
Yeah, so it's a good time.
We're sort of a turning point maybe between smack bang in the middle to things starting to ease down.
Yeah.
But no, generally still, like your garden still should be looking very good at the minute. It's still peak time. Like around here, August, obviously it's holiday time for a lot of people and stuff, so it should be pretty much prime time. You'd be hoping into September before you'd be looking at the first signs of autumn, really.
I know you've used that old adage that the spuds sort of come out on the 12th of July, but in reality, for many, they're still in the ground. Yes. What determines, you know, when someone lifts their potatoes? I mean, now, obviously, potato farmers know.
Yeah.
I'm on about, you know, that person that, you know, sows a couple of drills.
Yes. Generally, first thing with potatoes, potatoes need at least 100 days in the ground.
Right.
From you plant them up until you start digging. But it goes generally with a variety. Early varieties, like your Home Guards, your Queens, they don't last very long whenever they're picked. So generally, people pick them. They're ready earlier, but they don't last. So you pick them earlier and use them. You
need to get through them, yeah.
Whereas the weather... from September on, getting worse. Your main crop varieties, but they will keep right through to the spring.
Yeah.
Like your pinks, your golden wonders, stuff like that. So they will, so that's generally, the early ones are used sort of more frequently.
But do they spoil in the ground if you leave them too long, or is it not a bad place to put them until such time as you
generally went? Most potatoes be happy enough, even some of them into the spring.
Yeah.
The danger you're getting into that stage is... springtime regrowth, but a lot of time is frost.
Yeah, of course.
Frost can get into them, yeah. And generally if frost damages them, they sort of sweeten and then they won't keep after that.
Mm, okay. Tomatoes, how are tomatoes doing?
Everybody else's tomatoes seem to be doing great. Mine are not, so they're not. Basically, my father's
are you still putting it down to the sun?
Yes, pretty much. I'm putting down what I got. Actually, I think I put two, at my own house, I have a very small tunnel.
Yeah.
I think I put too much into it and actually killed the light.
I get you, I know what you're saying.
So, but no, tomatoes generally, they should be ripening up from now on.
Yeah.
So they should be, and it's very sort of important to stage that you almost, if you have a lot of foliage on them, start removing some of the lower foliage to allow the sun to get at the tomatoes themselves, exactly, to actually ripen them.
For the actual ripening process.
Yes.
Fresh tomato, how long will that last?
Fresh tomato generally, once again, suppose the ones you buy in the shops are picked.
That's what I was interested in.
Generally, fresh tomatoes, they're picked long before they're ready. Mm. And the ripen sort of in transit or in the shop. Whereas if you pick one at home, the reason a lot of people actually grow their own tomatoes is to actually pick them at home so you can pick a ripe tomato.
Yeah, for your lunch.
Pretty much, pick it off,
wash it, chop it.
Exactly, and that is, yeah. So you're not expecting them to last as long as the ones from the shop because it's very hard to get a ripe tomato in the shop that you're going to use today.
100%, yeah. And even, you know, if you buy a packet, they seem to be at various stages of ripeness, which makes it even more complicated. But the likes of carrots and onions, even yours are doing well. Even yours are doing well at the moment. Is now prime time for onions and carrots?
Pretty much now, coming in August, September, be sort of prime time if you're going to harvest your onions to preserve them for the winter.
Mm.
They'll actually get to full size and they'll dry out at that stage. Whereas at this time of year, I'd be harvesting like, say, one for today, if you know what I mean, because they probably wouldn't keep because they're not at full size yet.
Yeah, I get
but you're still using them as you go along.
Uh-huh. And would they be more bitter, sweet, more pungent, less pungent? Or
Definitely more pungent.
And are the onions you're growing white onions?
Yes, generally.
I don't really understand the point of red onions, to be honest with you. I always find it a great disappointment, but maybe it's our palate. We don't like anything too...
Apparently the way white onions are for cooking, red onions are for salad, and that you're not supposed to cook a red onion as well.
Really? Okay. Yeah.
So I don't know now. But
if you go into a deli, it's all red onions for your sandwiches and stuff, isn't it? Not all, sorry, but you know, prominently. Now also too, there's a bit of planning for the winter coming up. There's other crops that you plant now for the winter, is that right?
Yeah, pretty much. You begin into sort of your cabbage planting season. Cabbage you can sort of do year round.
Yeah.
But now it'd be a prime time for people starting to plant in new ones there. And wee bit early for the onions and garlic, probably been to sort of start of September around that. But certainly be planning from now on.
Something to look forward to. Right, your beds, your pots, your planting pots, etc. Freshen up time now, I suppose, as we are in the midst of summer.
Pretty much continue your deadheading and stuff like that. A lot of the perennial plants will be sort of starting to go to seed at this stage. So just get a tidy as you go, even a wee tidy for like an hour around the garden actually can make a huge difference.
And that deadheading, it seems that the plants really respond to that very quickly, don't they? It's almost like they're waiting on it.
Exactly. Yeah. And in this weather especially, because on a wet day like today, it'll actually put the old petals down into the plant, which can do a lot more harm. So
again, what do you do if it seems that the deadiness is sort of going beyond the head itself? Do you know what I mean? That the stalk, or whatever you call it, is looking a bit weathered?
Yes. Generally, I would tend to cut back.
And it's not pretty, just take it out.
Exactly, pretty much. And at this stage of the year as well, like with the best bowl in the world, some of the plants are sort of going past their best. And if it's in a pot of that, like, I wouldn't be scared to actually pull that plant out
and stick something else
replace
in
it with an autumn flowering thing. Like, sort of this time of year, dahlias are looking especially
that's a
well.
Good way to continue the colour or vibrancy into
exactly,
the,
yeah.
It start mixing it up now. Roses, we'll get questions on roses, not discouraging listeners, but is there any general advice just at the moment?
General advice, generally for a good display of roses, you would have fed them maybe back sort of 1st April around that. If you have done that, it'd be a good idea to give them another wee granular feed now. Just helps preserve the season going on. And if you see black spots starting to become like weller, like today is perfect for black spot. So if you see that, just take a treatment as you see fit.
Okay. Lawns.
Yes.
Lawns are, you drive around, everyone's lawn looks like Wimbledon at the moment, if they're lucky enough to have one.
Yes, absolutely. Lawns, funny, it's been a good enough year for lawns in the sense we haven't had a particularly long dry spell, which tends to dry them out, if you know what I mean. So, but at this time of year, weeds can sort of become apparent too, so it's not too late to scarify or anything. So it's not.
Yeah, people might feel that that's going to do more damage than good, but
yes.
You have to have a bit of confidence in it, don't you?
Pretty much, aye. And like, there's still plenty of growth there actually for the lawn to recover quite well.
All right, okay. Listen, keep your questions coming in. I'm going to take a really short break here now to give you an opportunity. We've got loads, by the way. We're not desperate, but we'd love to get your questions answered if you have them. So we're going to take a break. Paul's staying with us. Your gardening questions on the way. Good morning to John McLaughlin, who's listening from Boston, USA. We bumped into him at the broadcast from the Harcourt Hotel on Saturday, and it was great because he's Boston and he sounds like he's from Boston. That's exactly what you want a Boston man to be. And it was great to see Oisin and Brendan have a chat to him. So great to see you and glad you got home safe, John. And he says, please say hello from the McLaughlins in Boston to family in Carndonagh, Letterkenny, Rifo, Ardra and Derry, listening live from Massachusetts. All the best, John McLaughlin, Dan McLaughlin, Tom McLaughlin, Matthew McLaughlin. And I think John's dad is a particular fan of the show and listens to us or watches us every day. And it was just interesting, actually, because I wasn't in the broadcasting space at that time, and I think John recognised me from watching in the United States and came over and said hello. That's how small the world's got, Paul.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
Right.
And you just down the road and you don't even come and say hello to me. But anyway, why are my hydrangeas leaves turning pink?
Yes, not uncommon. So it happens a lot. Generally, it's to do with nitrogen, fertilizer deficiency.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the time, maybe the plants just run out of steam where it is. Generally, for leaves turning pink, it tends to be a phosphorus deficiency more so than anything else, which is kind of potash.
And is this seen as sort of a negative pink? I mean, on the face of it, it could sound like it's adding an extra bit of colour or something, but it is a sign of something negative.
To be honest, whenever that happens, generally the plant sort of, it looks like it lacks a bit of vigour, if you know what I mean. It doesn't have the natural green sort of hue to it. So potash deficiency, that there, you can actually buy potash directly. You could even use your old favourite bolted manure on it.
Yeah,
yes,
okay.
Pretty much would do the trick. Or if you want to go to a more organic route, it's actually, if you're a fan of bananas, so your banana skins around the bottom of the plant.
Mm.
They're fair full of potash as well.
Yeah, okay. Can you ask the question, when can I cut my laurel hedge for the second time?
Yes, for the second time, probably just assuming the first time was in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
So if they feel it needs another cut, you could cut away at any stage. So you could, a lot of time people would sort of leave it in September, but the law doesn't actually govern garden cutting. Generally it's from the 1st of September for big hedges. But so now cut away anytime.
Right, okay. Is it too late to plant Griselina now? And also a rough idea of price, approximately 100 metres to be hedged?
Yes, Griselina, no, you can plant it. Once a plant comes in a pot, the Griselina you can plant any time of year.
Mm.
The only thing I would tell you not to plant, if you were coming into a period of very good weather and very dry weather, I would tend to maybe leave it off to maybe September or so. But if the weather's going to stay the way it is, now you can plant away at any stage.
Yeah, if there's plenty of moisture around.
Yes, exactly. For a hedge, you'd be chatting about 2 plants per metre.
Yeah.
So you would be, so you're chatting about 200 plants.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So it could be 350, yeah, so, okay, 700. For 100 metres, Mm-hmm. You know, for something that's going to be there for a long time.
Exactly. It should be a lifetime investment.
Yeah, you would think so. Why is my hydrangea leaves turning pink? Did I ask that already?
Yeah.
It's fairly young, yet not flowered. There's a couple of people with the same question, actually.
Yes, so now generally what I got, generally a bit of feed. Now, should brighten them up for the winter.
I just don't think this is necessarily your fault, but you work in the garden sphere, so you probably have an answer. What can I do to prevent neighbours' cats from destroying my window boxes?
It can be difficult. All right, so it can, because funny, actually, I did a wee bit of planting in my own house last night, and I never thought about planting a cat mint among it.
Mm.
Came out this morning, the cat was lying on it.
Right,
so he was having a whale of a time. So it was, neighbours' cats can be problematic. The thing I would always say about that would be, if you have such a thing, a water pistol is very good, because it's just creating negative reinforcement.
Bad
experience, pretty much. If you're not there all the time to do that, sporadically put a wee bit of Vaseline around the pots and around the windowsill.
Yeah.
If that gets messed up in their fur, they don't like it. It's not going to do them any harm. So
I remember I had an issue with birds going down, landing on the flower pots and raking and tapping the beak off the glass.
Yeah.
And they couldn't be discouraged. I presume they were arguing with the reflection, which is sometimes what I seem to do. But, you know, so that can be an issue too. I'm not sure if you've heard of that. But
I've seen it already.
They've destroyed the flower boxes, pecking and...
Generally, they're looking for the wee insect.
All right, okay.
Around it. If you know, it's not the actual flowers, the attraction is the insect to that. So,
how do I prevent blight on my tomatoes or potatoes?
Yes, this time of year is just perfect for blight coming on, so it is. So prevent it. One thing is to promote good airflow. Blight generally likes sort of dead air, humid sort of air. So your tomatoes, even at this stage, cut some of the bottom foliage off, just lets more air through. It tends to keep it away a bit. You get fungicides that'll keep them away too. Some people like them, some people don't.
Yep.
And if you want to go organically, you can actually get a product called Bordeaux Mixture or Bluestone.
What is Bluestone?
Bluestone is copper sulfate.
Mm-hmm.
You probably, whenever you're doing science at school, you see the real blue stuff, you know what I mean? So there's a certain amount of copper in it, but it is a preventative thing for fungus.
And it's not it's a commercial product.
It's a commercial product, exactly. It was like back in the 40s, 50s, around here for potatoes, that nothing else.
Mm.
That was the thing. But it doesn't really work preventing the fungus and such. It builds up the plant and builds up a resistance within the plant
to
keep it away that way.
Okay.
You know what I mean? So, but it's certified organic as well.
Yeah. Caller wants to know, is it too late to feed the lawn?
Too late to feed the lawn? Absolutely not. Generally, a lot of people would build it up for the winter by putting in a sort of an autumn feed. The autumn feeds tend to be a wee bit different. They're less nitrogen in them to promote the growth of the green stuff. It's more to do with the roots. So if you get a specified autumn feed this time of year, you'd be perfect.
Can I lay new turf or sow grass seed now?
Yes and no. Once again, Simmons
plant just like the hedge,
plant the new hedge, exactly. If there comes a period of dry weather, especially for turf is actually, obviously it's an instant product, but it can be quite fickle in ways. So if it dries out, the mats tend to shrink and leave you with gaps.
Yeah.
So it's important. If you're there to keep it watered, sow away.
Yeah, and that's what it really comes down to. It's about if you get a dry spell, you're going to have to, and I'll tell you, if you're in a certain area, if you're in Milford, for an example, and you don't have water butts, you would have no real legal means to water
your lawn. Absolutely not. And the exit turf takes a huge amount of water. So it does. It takes about 2 weeks to establish. Once after 2 weeks, you're fine.
And what is happening there? Is it the roots at the bottom of the turf patch connecting with the soil on which it's been laid?
Pretty much. But the problem with it is whenever it's supplied to you, it comes like fully hydrated.
Yeah.
So you imagine you set down the bit of carpet, and as it dries out, it shrinks.
Yeah, of course.
So
then
it leaves you a big gap. So you end up having to like grout it almost with soil or something, which is just some a road you don't want to go down.
Well, especially because you're going for almost an instant fix and something that's aesthetically pleasing.
Yes.
Next thing, if you've got gaps and all, you're going, well, why did I get out? I could have just done it.
I just done it
way.
From seed. Exactly.
How do I deal with moss or weeds in the lawn in late summer?
Late summer, up to September, so it's still perfectly all right to scarify. And like I say, the growth's still going on, so it's the growth's still going on.
So we just remind this is what scarifying is.
Scarifier is a machine that actually rakes out.
Mm-hmm.
It goes between the blades of grass and it rakes out the weeds and
the stuff that's
the
more resistant, isn't it?
Exactly,
the grass will pass through. Some obviously will be sacrificed, but it will jag and grip mostly thick, mossy kind of stuff or weeds.
And once again, Simmons tomatoes, Simmons the but it is, increases airflow as well through it, if you know what I mean. So by pulling that out, then you're just generally improving the lawn, and you're actually, you should have less build-up of problems over the winter for next season.
Okay, so, really? So if you're very serious about your lawn, it probably should be something you're doing towards the end of the season.
Yes, exactly. Anyway, and if you do it now, if the recovery is still there, you don't have a bad-looking lawn for the winter.
Yeah, okay. Please ask Paul, can you sow wildflower seeds any time of the year, or are they, or are there particular months that suit them best? Thank you from Rosaline.
Yes, generally, what I got, you get ones to do all sort of all year round, but most of them are autumn or winter sowing, or sorry, autumn or spring sowing. So generally, a lot of people would say the autumn stuff works best because a lot of the plants need a period of cold to actually germinate and to come on nicely. So they do. So generally, probably end of now, September, be a perfect time to sow.
All right, brilliant. That's as many questions as we have time for now. Don't forget Paul McLaughlin and experts like he in all of the wonderful garden centres across the region are more than happy for you to come in, ask questions, show your pictures. He'll even open Google Maps and give you ideas if you're looking to hedge your lawn or something along those lines. Very ingenious they are at Ballagher Garden Centre. Paul McLaughlin, thanks very much. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Yes, thank
thanks
you.
Thanks for the jam, stroke, oh, preserve, stroke, jelly?
Yes, absolutely.
Right, okay. Right, I appreciate it. Thank you very much indeed. And I think, yes, we got to most of the questions there. There's a few duplicates that sort of the answers overlapped. But thank you to each and every one of you. Paul, back in a couple of weeks. Right, just returning to the issue of defective concrete blocks. For some, they're able to progress on the schemes. It might be working for them. For others, it's a frustrating process. And I think for the majority, they've yet to really taste it, because in terms of the amount of houses affected versus those that are sort of in the process up until the point maybe of demolition, rebuilding, that the numbers are relatively small compared to the numbers that are affected overall. Paul is in the scheme. He's in the process. I suppose, Paul, you were seeing some light at the end of the tunnel, but unfortunately, if I'm reading this correctly, that seems to be dashed for you now.
Well, yeah, we've spent 4 years getting to this point where we had a date confirmed and all with the developer that we've appointed to come and basically tumble the house and get it built. And that date was the 1st of September. And we've spent 4 years getting to this point between testing, going through the scheme, delay after delay, argument after argument, and living in a house that we shouldn't be living in. Anyway, we got to the point where the builder committed to come in on the 1st of September, and I got a phone call from him there this morning now to say that he won't be coming in September, that he can't see him coming in any time this year and next year at the earliest. And it's all down to difficulty in getting payments from the scheme for the houses that he has, you know, that he's currently building. He's building 3 to 4 houses at the minute, and the money's just not coming from the scheme to, you know, to fund what he's doing. He started the house in April, hasn't got a payment to date, despite everything going into the council. One of the top engineers is gone. Everything's correct on their side. Apparently, the paperwork's been sent back due to not even errors, but just due to stupid things that they're looking for. And each time it goes back, it's in the next 6 to 7 weeks then before that paperwork's processed. So,
Paul, I want you to continue your story, but let's say this builder says, right, I'm not doing your house, I'm doing a fresh new build. He knows he's going to get a payment at the square when the roof goes on, when the house is sealed. You know, like, there is a plan, and builders work very much to that plan. There has to be a certainty, because there's massive outlays in terms of materials and wages. And why take on that kind of aggro when I'm sure he's got a new build as well ready to go in September, where he knows he'll very unlikely experience that? Why can't we employ the same systems we do with architects and you know, new non-defective concrete block builds like we do in the scheme? Everything would move much quicker.
Listen, I'm not blaming the Boulder one.
No, no, of course not. No, you don't come across like that at all.
No, I know you're not, but it's just totally down to the scheme not working, down to the, I don't know what it is, where the problem lies, whether it's manpower that they don't have in the council to cope with the amount of stuff that's going into them. But I mean, we're in a position where now we have a property to move into. Do we move into it? And with the uncertainty of not knowing how long we're going to be in for it, we had planned to be in for it maybe a year, 12 months at the most. I mean, straight away now there's an extra 6 months added on to that rental expense, and I really am thinking about ringing them and telling them no, and just to give it to somebody else.
But what happens if you get the okay in March or things change and next thing you know you can't find another property? You're being left in an awful situation here. Gamble 12 months of rent and things already tight, or risk not having anywhere to move into if your project can progress.
Yeah. Listen, it's unbelievable the amount of stress and strain that's involved without this being heaped on top of it. I rang my local councillor there, usual old stuff. Give me your name, give me your house address, and your reference number for the scheme. I mean, who else do you ring? He says I asked him who's at fault for the delay in the payments going out to the contractors, and he says it's the housing agency. He's apparently the housing agency released the money to the council, and then the council released the money to the. It's just a whole mess. And I wouldn't advise anybody get on, even start without, before things improve. I mean, I have a top engineer, luckily enough, I have one of the best engineers, that you could appoint, but I mean, he can do nothing. All he can do is get his paperwork right. But at the minute, I was talking to him this morning, and he just said that they're being promised that things are going to improve, but he says he's been listening to that for months. And it is getting to the point now where developers are going to pull the pin, and developers are hard to get at the best of times. But I mean, if there's any sense at all that things are going to be delayed, builders aren't going to be. I mean, you can't blame them. How can any developer take on a project costing $400,000 to $500,000 not knowing when he's going to get his money?
But the problem, very frustrating situation for you, Paul, is you actually are being hit by the experience with other developments. You've done everything you can. You've plugged away in this the scheme. You've overcome every hurdle that's been put in front of you. You even were lucky enough to secure alternative accommodation, and now you're being told, a month or so out, that the builder, simply because of his experience of trying to progress a house on the scheme, he can't commit to starting yours, the demolition in September. And it's none of this is your fault. It all goes back to that phrase right from the very beginning. You're faultless in this, and yet the scheme is slapping you around the face again, and the whole family as well. And how many times can you drag your boots up, Meg? How many times can you?
No, I mean, you can't. I mean, you can only put up with so much. You can only put up with so much. And it was just a real kick in the stomach this morning when I got that phone call, because we have furniture, we have everything in storage. And it's just so frustrating,
And it was related to you, was it, Paul, that it's been pernickety with stuff? So, in other words, when a payment is due, it's not that the payment itself is delayed, it's that the housing agency are being pernickety with things and seeking extra paperwork and then delaying in responding, etc. Is that where the problems lie?
Well, I don't know who to blame at this stage. Yeah,
okay. All right, listen, thanks for that, Paul. I hope things improve for you. That's why, some are saying we need an end-to-end sort of scheme, that it shouldn't necessarily be householders or the builders or the contractors that are having to deal with all of this. If you are a contractor or a developer and you have experience of the scheme and you can give us your perspective on it a little bit, it might be really useful. I don't think anyone who's waiting on a contractor on site is blaming contractors if the scheme is hard to get paid on, because there's big expense, there's big outlays, and you need to know when your money's coming through to keep your business going. And it should be made as stress-free, as seamless as is humanly possible. No one's trying to screw the government out of anything. People are just trying to get their houses rebuilt. So if you are a builder or a developer and you've been engaging with the what seems to be the housing agency on stage payments, etc., please, if you can, get in touch with us, 086 60 25,000, or call us on 07491 25,000. We'd be interested to get your views. Okay, we were talking earlier on about conspiracy theorists and a study as to how they become conspiracy theorists and how they can go down a rabbit hole and what they might end up doing. Caller says, AI just told me 5 conspiracy theories proven right. 1, Twitter censorship, suppression of origin and potential treatments. That must be COVID, yep. 2, lab leak derided as fringe, now credible. Well, Donald Trump says it was a lab leak. 2, serious vaccine side effects. 4, vaccine potential driving new variants. 5, lockdown, ushered in surveillance, digital ID tracking, etc. Now, if it was Grok that you used, obviously Grok is drawing its information from Twitter stroke X. That's its primary source of information, so you are going to... But anyway, listen, that's what you're getting, and that's fine. To be fair, conspiracy theories have ended up being proven to be fact. I just asked AI to list 10, and they popped up from MK Ultra Project, Sunshine Operation, Mockingbird NSA, a surveillance, geoengineering to EMF. That sounds like Grok at it again, which is fine. I'm not disputing it. I don't believe a man ever landed on the moon. It's a hard one to process whether or not a person ever landed on the moon. Like, it's astonishing if they did. And I am not a conspiracy theorist per se. But when you see the attempts that are happening at the moment that are proving unsuccessful from the Chinese and others, and the fact that we haven't really done it much since, and then you see the machine that actually did land on the moon and take off, it would be easy to sort of say, could it possibly have happened? I'm regarded as a conspiracy theorist, says this listener, because of my views. But to me, the evidence just doesn't add up. The technology of the time, the Van Allen belt radiation, etc., having a different opinion or view shouldn't make you a subject of decision or division or ridicule. But of course, conspiracy theory is, it's like the word turf. Turf was seen as an insult, but if you own the word turf, it kind of dilutes it as an insult, and that's problematic to your opposition. Or if you label someone with a different view to yours as a conspiracy theorist and make that a bad word, the same has been done with the woke word, you know yourself. Another caller says, why not ban gambling like smoking? Problem solved. Well, there was a massive lobby for resisting the ban on smoking, a massive lobby, and it took a long time to get over the line. Gambling is intertwined in every element of society. It's very hard to see that being banned. All right, going to take a quick break, and then in studio with me is Aaron Friel. The Newtown Cunningham community are holding a celebration at the Columban Hall on the Main Street, Newtown Cunningham, to show the support and gratitude for the very talented Aaron Friel, who brought home a 400-metre bronze Olympic medal from the European Youth Olympics in Macedonia last week. And that is Friday night at 7 p.m, so get along if you're in the area. But we're delighted to welcome into our area Aaron Friel. Hi, Aaron.
Hi.
How are you getting on?
I'm good, thank you.
And what a fantastic experience. At what stage of the season are you at? Do you know what I mean in terms of the progress and what you're building to? Or
I'm kind of at the end of my season now, so I have one more championships. I'm going on Tuesday to Finland for the European Under-20s, where I'll be racing in the 4x400, and then that'll be my season finished then.
So you clocked a new personal best of 54.02 in the final. To be doing that at this part of the season, it means, you know, things are working really well for you.
Yeah, definitely. We've kind of planned out the season this year, me and my coach, so that I'm not going to be tired out by this point of the season, whereas last year I spent so long chasing a time for the under-18 Europeans, so I was kind of raced out by the time I got to this point. But this year we've kind of done it very smart, so I'm at the same point as I was at the start, but I seem to be getting not that I'm getting faster, but I'm kind of where I should be at this point. And to come away with the PB at this stage of the season, I was so happy.
54.02 at this stage of your career. Do you have a number you think you can get to at some point in your career?
I haven't really
thought. Is that how it works?
Yeah, well, kind of, but I haven't really thought much about times. It's kind of, they'll come when they come.
Yeah.
I just have to keep injury free, keep enjoying it, keep training, and then the times will come themselves.
Yeah, okay. And that's part of a psychology, isn't it? So you don't get fixated on a particular
Definitely.
Area.
Psychology is such a big thing.
I would say if you ran 56 seconds and won a gold medal at the Olympics, you wouldn't be crying about the time.
No, definitely.
Do you know what I mean?
Definitely
like, it's not possibly likely, but no. You know.
That's the time I was running kind of at the start of the season. So to come down to the time I am now is... I shocked myself with that.
Yeah.
But definitely psychology is such a big thing. Mm. I don't think people actually realise it's probably the main thing in it, even more than your training. Because if you go into a race thinking you can't do it, you're going to lose, then you will lose. But I've kind of changed my attitude from that. So going into every race now, I know that I have the training to back the performance. So I go in with full confidence.
Yeah, you've done everything that you need to do and you can trust yourself on the track.
Exactly, and I trust my coach too. She has me prepared so well for everything I do, so I have no worries going into any race.
Yeah, and how controlled do you have to be, you know, at the start of a race? Because sometimes I come in here like, and I could be hyperventilating, right? Just because of being nervous or anxious or something, right? So do you have a routine sort of on the starting blocks, in inverted commas, that keeps you in the zen, just ready to explode into the race?
Not really as such. Well, I kind of struggled a few years ago when I was younger. I'd struggle with nerves really bad, and I would go into every single race so nervous, and I would just be thinking, I don't want to be here, I don't want to do this.
How can I run a fast time with jelly legs?
Yeah, right, I know. Okay, yeah. But now, I don't really know. Everyone asks me what changed that, but I actually don't know.
I think it's the process. You
I
trust the process,
is.
Isn't it?
But even like when I was racing my 400 there last week, I went into every single race as if it was like a race down at the track, as if I was just training. Like I had no nerves at all. And I was kind of confused myself why I had no nerves, because it was such a big thing. But I was so relaxed going into it and I was just so excited to run.
Mm.
But I think for me, when I'm warming up, I make up a story in my head.
Right.
Or I think of something completely different as if I'm not actually running. And I kind of just don't think about it then.
It just works
nervous.
For you, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, I asked you probably a silly question about, you know, could there be a career best time in you? But when you look at people, someone like Mark English, for an example, to all intents and purposes, you could imagine that he's, you know, heading towards the end of his career, but he's banging out career best times.
He seems to be getting faster the older he gets.
He's a machine.
I know, he really is.
So there's plenty, you have plenty of time.
Hopefully.
It's a completely individual sport. I mean, I know you do run as part of a team, but running it's just you, isn't it?
It definitely is. Like, well, as soon as you get out on the track, it's just you. If you run a bad time, it's on you. If you run a good time, it's on you. Whatever happens out there, it's on you.
Mm.
So it definitely is completely individual.
Do you race the course or the people around you?
I try not to race the people around me.
Mm.
I kind of just run my own race. Like last week, I had everyone on the team, my family, everyone warned not to tell me anything about the girls in my race.
Right.
I didn't want to know their names. I didn't want to know their times. I wanted to know nothing about them, because I know myself that if I knew the times of the girls I was racing against, I would be going out there thinking of that.
Mm.
And I didn't want that. I just wanted to go out and run my own race, and whatever happens, happens.
And that fits into you being in your own story mode. This is just a training session. I'm just going to do a series of silly questions and then I'll ask probably more interesting questions. When you run a time, right, you know, how close can you imagine the time? You know immediately it's a fast time, right? But we could be talking 0.2 of a second,
mm-hmm.
but you're so tuned in and you've done it so often, you can probably tell, no, that was a quick one.
Sometimes, well, not all the time actually.
Okay.
But sometimes I come off and I think that I know that was a fast time before I even look at it. Or sometimes I think I could have been better. But I don't think people realise, like, 0.2 of a second in sprinting in 400 metres is so, so much.
Mm.
Okay, it's not so, so much, but it is a lot.
It could be
a big gap. It's
first and fourth, potentially.
It is. It was a difference between second and third out there.
Yeah.
I think it was 0.3 or 0.4, was the difference between me and the silver medal. So it is so much, but...
How competitive are you, though? Ultra, ultra, ultra competitive, right?
Definitely. Okay. I'm competitive in everything. Even a board game, I'm competitive.
Yeah, good. I like it. So can you see this is a win, or are you kicking yourself about the 0.2 that didn't get you a silver? But where does that end? What was it, 0.4 to gold? Do you know what I mean? Like,
it was... Well, to be fair, the girl that won gold was more than 0.2 seconds. Okay. She was just amazing, but... I'll get there someday to that level, but I try not to think too much of times.
Yeah.
Because any time, I realised it last year that when I went into a race thinking about a time, I never got the time. But when I went in not thinking about it, I came out with a better time.
Mm.
So I try not to think about that and just see what happens then.
I was listening to a bit of an interview with a golfer, John Ram, I think it was, and he was talking about how, you know, he started playing golf when he was like 3 or something, and he's built up to it, and... you know, he became number one in the world and then went on to win the prize that he dreamt of all his life. And 5 minutes later, it kind of didn't really mean much, if you know what I mean, because he was just on to the next thing then.
I know,
and he had to deal with that a bit, because it was like, well, this is everything I've been built up to, but now it feels like ages ago and just a memory. What next?
I know. Well, like, that race feels like nearly a month ago now, and it was last Tuesday. It feels like so long ago, and I had such a buzz after that. But then... by the evening time, I was kind of, not that I forgot about it, but I was on to the next thing. I still had the relay to run. The relay was on Thursday, so I kind of had to put it out of my mind and just focus on that. So it is like that. You just, you move on to the next thing straight away.
Yeah, and what motivates you? Is it simply winning?
It's not winning. Like, I'm not that I don't care about winning. Obviously, everyone loves to win, but I think it's just the feeling after.
Yeah.
When you know you've, like, achieved your own goal and, like, running a fast time or a PB or whatever, when you know you've achieved that, that's just, it's the best feeling. I can't even explain it. It doesn't always have to be winning, but to come away with the medal, especially last week, that, even though it was bronze, that was winning to me.
Yeah, so it's all really personal to you, and this is all your individual motivations. One other silly question, right? So you're in the peak of fitness, right? You burst off the blocks, 400 metres, done and dusted in no time at all, under a minute. How draining is that? Do you know, how long does it take to recover from that explosion of energy release?
It takes far too long.
Yeah.
After 400, it is, I can't even explain the pain after it, but it's...
Because if you're like a coiled, it's like a coiled spring that you just pop and release, yeah?
I normally, in my 400, I would go out hard.
Mm.
It's just, can't really help it, I just go out hard. And then by the time I get to the 200 mark, that's where I start feeling the burn
in
my legs.
You'd start digging there, yeah.
I kind of just have to keep going from that point.
Yeah.
But after, I would say it takes a long time to recover, but to kind of be able to walk again takes about 10, 20 minutes. But
amazing, isn't it?
I know, when you're lying.
It's such in a short period.
It is.
You know, if you run a marathon, it kind of maybe makes more sense, but I suppose it's just that massive release of energy.
I know, and it was only like, I'm running for less than a minute, but I'm running as hard as I possibly can for less than a minute, so it really does. And my coach always says speed kills when I'm training. When I'm doing the fast stuff, that's the hardest sessions, the speed sessions, even more than endurance sessions. So it's the speed I'm going at that makes it really painful.
With so much of you into what you do, do you be nervous of injury, or can you afford to be nervous of injury? Because that could stifle your training then, I suppose.
You can't really worry about an injury that hasn't happened yet, but hopefully I won't get injured. I never have been injured, but I try not to think about it too much. But it is like sometimes if I'm just walking somewhere and my legs are a bit tight.
Oh no.
It's the first thing you think of, because an injury can put you out for so long and I don't know what I would do.
Brilliant stuff. When do you, and I presume it is a natural passage transition from the youth setup to the seniors?
Well, I'm under 18 now, but next season I'll be under 19, under 20. So I think you go up as far as under 23. And then you're senior after that.
Yeah.
So I have up until then.
And you don't skip it. That is a process you go through.
That is. You can't skip that.
Okay. And do you get to enjoy the experiences outside of the race themselves? I mean, you're getting to travel great places and wonderful experiences. Surely enjoying that has to be part of the process.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I had the best week of my life there last week. I didn't want to leave at the end of it. But it's such...
Could you have a McFlurry a day before a race?
Probably not. You can have it the day after, okay, but maybe not before. But like, every race is in such a unique country. Like, it's not a country you'd think of going to, Macedonia. I don't think I ever would have went there if it wasn't for running. But as I said, I had the best week ever. And you do get to experience so much with... And it's so much better when you're traveling all these places with doing something you love.
Yeah. So you're going from Macedonia to Finland. Finland next Tuesday.
Yeah, Finland next Tuesday for the under-20s. Mm. I'm only doing the four by 400 relay next week. Next Saturday is the first round.
All right, so you're not doing individual racing next week?
I'm not doing individual racing next week, just the 4x4.
Cool.
So I'm so excited for that.
400, obviously, where you're winning medals. But you talked about going out the blocks fast. 200 metres, are they on the cards?
Well, I do. At the start of my season, I would do 60 metres.
Okay.
Which is even shorter.
Yeah, yeah.
I hate that, but my coach always makes me do it.
Right.
But I know what she means when she makes me do it. I know it helps so much, the speed for the 400. But I do some 200s and kind of enjoy them. Not as much as a 400, but I know I need them for my speed, so I do.
Brilliant. I didn't really think that partaking in that would be part of the strategy to the fours, for an example. Are you going to enjoy tomorrow night? Can you, you know, you're going to enjoy it, aren't you? It's lovely.
Of course
your own community. Yeah, you know, but some people go, oh no, not me.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's your community saying, wow, we're so proud of you.
It
must be wonderful.
It's
going to be huge numbers. You're excited for it.
I'm so excited for that. And I just want to thank everyone for all the support. And I didn't realise how much people were actually supporting me until I came home and I seen it all there.
Oh, it's huge.
And people coming
huge
up to me and congratulate me and everything. It means so much.
And it's not just in your own local area.
It's all not.
Incredibly proud of you, Erin. And you're a lovely person as well. Thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you so much.
Good luck tomorrow night, 7 p.m. Get out and support Erin. And also we'll keep an eye on her in the European Championships in Finland. She heads out there very, very shortly. Thanks, Erin.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Lovely to have you in. Okay, that's where we leave it on the show today. We're back tomorrow live from... Kavanagh Super Value in Dunloe as part of the 58th International Merry from Dunloe Festival. We've got the Friday panel, live music, lots of chat, great fun. But stay tuned today. John Breslin's next around the Northwest.